This is Audible.
From the Sugar Act to the shot heard round the world, America before the Revolution, 1764 to 1775. Written by Charles River Editors, narrated by Nicholas S. Johnson. Introduction. The Revolution was effected before the war commenced. The Revolution was in the minds and hearts of the people. This radical change in the principles, opinions, sentiments, and affections of the people was the real American Revolution. John Adams, 1818. The American Revolution is replete with seminal moments that every American learns in school, from the shot heard round the world to the Declaration of Independence. But the events that led up to the fighting at Lexington and Concord were born out of 10 years of division between the British and their American colonies over everything from colonial representation in governments to taxation, the nature of searches, and the quartering of British regulars in private houses. From 1764 to 1775, a chain of events that included lightning rods like the Townsend Acts led to bloodshed in the form of the Boston Massacre, while the Boston Tea Party became a symbol of nonviolent protest. In the summer of 1774, patriot groups around the 13 colonies communicated with each other and brought about the first council that would unite all of them. That September, 56 delegates who had been chosen by their colonial legislatures to attend the First Continental Congress met in Philadelphia to craft a united response to the intolerable acts, debate the merits of a boycott of British trade, declare their rights, and demand redress. The First Continental Congress eventually petitioned the British government to end the intolerable acts, while also determining to convene again the following summer. As it turned out, the Revolution would be underway before the Second Continental Congress would convene. Chapter 1. The Sugar Act of 1764. From an early age, every American learns about the taxes and disputes that eventually led to war between Great Britain and her 13 colonies. The Sugar Act, the Stamp Act, the Boston Massacre, the Boston Tea Party, and the notion of no taxation without representation. Of course, the American narrative often ignores or overlooks why the British pursued the path that ultimately brought about the American Revolution. In 1763, the British concluded the Seven Years' War with a decisive victory over the French that left France with almost no colonial possessions in North America. Although the Seven Years' War, known as the French and Indian War in the United States, was a crushing defeat for the French and a resounding success for Great Britain, the war itself put the kingdom deep in debt. To help alleviate the burden, Parliament soon began to pass a number of additional taxes to repay the nation's war debts. Many of the new taxes targeted the 13 colonies, and the logic for raising revenue in the colonies was clear. After all, the Seven Years' War had begun in North America, and a great deal of Britain's war expenses had gone towards supporting and defending the 13 colonies. Moreover, the 13 colonies were relatively untaxed by Great Britain compared to England, Scotland, and Wales. Finally, no member of Parliament represented the 13 colonies, so Parliament could increase taxes on the colonies without a great deal of parliamentary opposition or backlash among British citizens. This last fact, while convenient for Parliament, created a great deal of ill will in the 13 colonies. Many colonists believed that Parliament had no right to raise taxes when the colonies had no representation in Parliament, and they pointed out the fact that the King of England had long since surrendered any claim to raise taxes without the consent of the people's representatives in Parliament. A Parliament without a single American member, the colonists argued, could no more legally raise taxes on them than the King could on British citizens. Taxation without representation was, in the colonists' view, a violation of their rights as Englishmen. The first of these taxes was the Sugar Act in 1764, passed by Parliament on April 5, 1764. It has also been called the American Revenue or Duties Act, an act for the better securing and encouraging the trade of His Majesty's sugar colonies in America, for applying the produce of such duties, and of the duties to arise by virtue of the said act, towards defraying the expenses of defending, protecting, and securing the said colonies and plantations, and for altering and disallowing several drawbacks on exports from this kingdom, and more effectually preventing the clandestine conveyance of goods to and from said colonies and plantation, and improving and securing the trade between the same and Great Britain. The expenses of defending, protecting, and securing the said colonies and plantations refers to recent expenses Britain had incurred during the Seven Years' War. In the American colonies, the battles were primarily fought between the colonists and the French, who allied with the Native Americans in an attempt to establish domination on disputed lands located along the borders between French and English colonies in Virginia, Nova Scotia, and Canada. The British sent armies to America to protect the farms and towns that were being threatened, and now wanted the American colonies to help defray the cost of that protection. One of the oft-forgotten aspects of the British taxes on the colonies in the 1760s is that they were not terribly repressive. In fact, some of the British measures that were opposed by the colonists actually lowered the prices colonists paid for imported goods, including the Tea Act of 1773. The Sugar Act of 1764 was one of the British taxes that ostensibly lowered the price of imported goods because it lowered the duty on molasses from 6 pence to 3, thereby replacing the duty imposed by the Molasses Act of 1733. New England merchants who imported barrels of molasses from the West Indies for the manufacture of rum had not protested the original Molasses Act of 1733's 6 pence duty 30 years earlier. Of course, this raises an obvious question. Why would colonists protest the Sugar Act of 1764, which lowered the tax on imported molasses, but not the Molasses Act of 1733, which created the tax in the first place? The answer can be found in the Sugar Act's language, particularly that the act was designed for more effectually preventing the clandestine conveyance of goods to and from said colonies and plantation. This referred to problems Britain had had in the past collecting taxes levied by the Molasses Act of 1733. This tax was designed to both raise revenue for Great Britain and regulate trade between the West Indies, who produced the molasses, and the American colonies, primarily New England, who produced it into rum. The tax had raised tariffs on all non-British suppliers of molasses in order to force those using it to purchase it from their preferred producers. The problem was that the colonists on both sides of the issue soon became adept at smuggling molasses past British officials and avoiding paying the tax. In other words, the colonists were able to ignore the 6 pence tax from the Molasses Act, but the Sugar Act threatened to make it more difficult to avoid the 3 pence tax via smuggling. Moreover, the Sugar Act extended the tax to several other types of non-British products, specifically certain types of fabric, dyes, coffee, and wine. Whereas it is expedient that new provisions and regulations should be established for improving the revenue of the kingdom, and for extending and securing the navigation and commerce between Great Britain and Your Majesty's dominions in America, which by the peace have been so happily enlarged, and whereas it is just and necessary that a revenue be raised in Your Majesty's said dominions in America for defraying the expenses of defending, protecting, and securing the same, towards raising the said revenue in America, there shall be raised, levied, collected, and paid unto His Majesty, his heirs and successors, for and upon all white or clayed sugars of the produce or manufacture of any colony or plantation in America, for and upon indigo and coffee of foreign produce or manufacture, for and upon wines, except French wine, for and upon all wrought silks, bengals, and stuffs mixed with silk or herbs of the manufacture of Persia, China, or East India, and all calico painted, dyed, printed, or stained there, and for and upon all foreign linen cloth called cambric, and French lawns, which shall be imported or brought into any colony or plantation in America. In addition to taxing these items, the Sugar Act also prohibited the colonies from selling their valuable lumber to anyone but Britain. With widespread deforestation plaguing much of Europe, countries were clamoring for the seemingly endless supply of American lumber, and the colonies were only too happy to supply it, for a price. However, by limiting sales to Britain alone, Parliament in essence gave itself the right to dictate how much or how little any colonist could be paid for his property. One of the biggest problems with the Sugar Act was the timing. Because it was an indirect tax, the American people knew about it but could not see it clearly in action. What they did see was a serious decline in the revenues they had been collecting for providing the British soldiers stationed in America during the war with food and other supplies. While the end of the war would obviously eliminate the need for many of these supplies, the economic downturn which followed seemed to be more associated with the Sugar Act than with the natural cycle of a post-war economic depression. In short, the colonists blamed the tax and the parliament that had passed it without their permission for much of their economic woes. To top it off, the Sugar Act was only applied to the colonies and not other citizens of Great Britain, which in the colonists' minds naturally made them less equal as Englishmen. Had everyone been taxed equally, there might not have been as much of a problem. The philosophy behind the colonists' complaints was amply displayed by the writings of Samuel Adams. In May of 1764, the Boston Town Meeting met to elect representatives to the Massachusetts House of Representatives. As was customary, the representatives were then provided with a set of instructions on issues to bring up to the representative of the Crown. Adams was chosen to write these instructions, and in doing so, he sought to make the body aware of both the colonists' fears and what they expected their leaders to do about them. But what still heightens our apprehensions is that these unexpected proceedings may be preparatory to new taxations upon us, for if our trade may be taxed, why not our lands? Why not the produce of our lands and everything we possess or make use of? This, we apprehend, annihilates our charter right to govern and tax ourselves. It strikes at our British privileges, which, as we have never forfeited them, we hold in common with our fellow subjects who are natives of Britain. If taxes are laid upon us in any shape without our having legal representation where they are laid, are we not reduced from the character of free subjects to the miserable statue of tributary slaves? We therefore earnestly recommend it to you to use your utmost endeavors to obtain in the General Assembly all necessary instructions and advice to our agent at this most critical juncture, that while he is setting forth the unshaken loyalty of this province and this town, its unrivaled exertions in supporting His Majesty's government and rights in this part of his dominions, its acknowledged dependence upon and subordination to Great Britain, and the ready submission of its merchants to all just and necessary regulations of trade, he may be able in the most humble and pressing manner to remonstrate for us all those rights and privileges which justly belong to us either by charter or birth. Samuel Adams' instructions were much more than just recommendations to his fellow politicians. They were a summary of what the Americans found offensive in their treatment by Britain, and what they felt should be done about it. Never before had anyone in the colonies gone on record against the rights of Parliament to tax those whom they did not represent. When his statements were published in newspapers throughout New England, they marked the beginning of a new movement that actually said out loud what so many had been thinking. Parliament did not have the right to govern New England or any of the other colonies. Chapter 2. The Stamp Act of 1765. Ironically, while the colonists felt their lack of representation meant Parliament couldn't tax them, that same lack of representation made it politically convenient for Parliament to tax them without having to answer to any of its actual constituents. Thus, for the same reason the colonists were upset, the British were not terribly interested in political arguments made by the likes of Samuel Adams. Unsatisfied with the revenue it was gleaning from the Sugar Act, Parliament followed it with the Stamp Act of 1765, also known as the Duties in American Colonies Act of 1765. Unlike the Sugar Act, the Stamp Act was a direct tax that required many of the documents produced as part of the everyday legal and business activities of the colony to be printed on specially embossed and stamped paper only produced by the British government. Among the items required to bear this stamp were legal documents, newspapers, and magazines. To make matters worse, this paper could only be purchased with British sterling certificates, not the paper money used in the colonies. Since Parliament controlled the exchange rate, they also controlled how much each page actually cost. While the Sugar Act was something of a sullen undercurrent, the Stamp Act was a constant reminder of Parliament's power over the colonies, and it was almost certainly designed as a show of force of sorts by Parliament. Whereas they had for more than a century considered themselves to be good Englishmen, with the same rights and duties as any other loyal subject, they now saw themselves as something akin to unloved stepchildren, tolerated, provided for, and disciplined, but without the same rights as the other English citizens. The colonial response in Massachusetts was swift. Working on behalf of himself and his neighbors, John Adams sent a resolution to the Massachusetts legislature that became a model for other towns in the colonies to make their displeasure known. He even went as far as to write 4 letters that were published in various newspapers in the colony, stating that the descendants of the Puritans owed it to their ancestors to resist unjust laws. By the end of the year, he had publicly decried the act as violating 2 principles of British law, the right to be tried by jury and to be taxed only by consent. In 1765, the Stamp Act Congress met in New York City. Called by James Otis, Jr., it met in New York during the middle 2 weeks of October that year and was comprised of representatives from all 13 colonies. The Congress was tasked with appealing to Great Britain for some sort of relief, either in the form of the Sugar and Stamp Acts being repealed or the American colonies being represented in Parliament. In the end, they produced a declaration of rights and grievances to the king that read in part, "Whereas, since the close of the last year, the British Parliament, claiming a power of right to bind the people of America by statute in all cases whatsoever, hath, in some facts, expressly imposed taxes on them, and in others, under various pretenses, but in fact for the purpose of raising a revenue, hath imposed rates and duties payable in these colonies, established a board of commissioners with unconstitutional powers, and extended the jurisdiction of courts of admiralty, not only for collecting the said duties, but for the trial of causes merely arising within the body of a county. And whereas assemblies have been frequently dissolved, contrary to the rights of the people, when they attempted to deliberate on grievances, and their dutiful, humble, loyal, and reasonable petitions to the Crown for redress have been repeatedly treated with contempt by His Majesty's Ministers of State. The good people of the several colonies, justly alarmed at these arbitrary proceedings of Parliament and administration, have severally elected, constituted, and appointed deputies to meet and sit in General Congress in the city of Philadelphia, in order to obtain such establishment as their religion, laws, and liberties may not be subverted. Whereupon the duties so appointed being now assembled, in a full and free representation of these colonies, taking into their most serious consideration the best means of attaining the ends aforesaid, do in the first place, as Englishmen, their ancestors in like cases have usually done, for asserting and vindicating their rights and liberties, declare that the inhabitants of the English colonies in North America, by the immutable laws of nature, the principles of the English Constitution, and the several charters or compacts, have the following rights: that they are entitled to life, liberty, and property, and they have never ceded to any sovereign power whatever a right to dispose of either without their consent. All and each of the aforesaid deputies, in behalf of themselves and their constituents, do claim, demand, and insist on, as their indubitable rights and liberties, which cannot be legally taken from them, altered, or abridged by any power whatsoever, without their own consent, by their representatives in their several provincial legislatures." While the Congress's protests were still peaceful, other Bostonians took to the streets in protests organized by the Loyal Nine, a secret but well-organized patriot group. Operating before the Sons of Liberty, which later incorporated them, little is still known about the Loyal Nine, although it is known that the membership included Secretary John Avery, a distiller, Henry Bass, a cousin of Samuel Adams, Thomas Case, a distiller, Stephen Cleverly, a brazier, Thomas Crafts, a painter, Benjamin Eads, printer of the Boston Gazette, Joseph Field, a ship captain, John Smith, a brazier, and George Trott, a jeweler. The Loyal Nine formed in response to the Stamp Act and quickly went about work protesting it in a variety of ways. The group put up anti-Stamp Act pamphlets and signage in the streets of Boston, and in August 1765, this group of men led protests in which British stamp distributor Andrew Oliver was hanged in effigy from the Liberty Tree, which the Loyal Nine established itself, followed by the destruction of his office. Lieutenant Governor and future Royal Governor Thomas Hutchinson also had his home destroyed by a mob. The Loyal Nine identified the targets for mobs, but still had the influence and capability to determine how far the protests would escalate. John Adams described one meeting with members of the Loyal Nine in January 1766, though by that time they had informally become part of the Sons of Liberty. January 15, 1766. I spent the evening with the Sons of Liberty at their own appointment in Hanover Square, near the Tree of Liberty. It is a counting room in Chase and Speakman's distillery. A very small room it is. There were present John Avery, a distiller of liberal education, John Smith, the brazier, Thomas Crafts, the painter, Benjamin Eads, the printer, Stephen Cleverly, brazier, Thomas Case, distiller, Joseph Field, master of a vessel, Henry Bass, George Trott, jeweler, and Henry Wells. I was very cordially and respectfully treated by all present. We had punch, wine, pipes and tobacco, biscuit and cheese, etc. They chose a committee to make preparation for a grand rejoicing upon the arrival of the news of the repeal of the Stamp Act. Samuel Adams had connections with the Loyal Nine, and no doubt inspired and influenced them, but he was a collaborator with the group, not a member. Nevertheless, when he acquired the reputation as being the leader of the Boston mob during the 1760s, protests like this and the Boston Tea Party were accredited to him anyway. Historians have long disagreed about how much influence Adams actually had over the common Boston citizen. Some have gone as far as to accuse him of controlling the citizens as a trained mob, while others have been more inclined to point out that he often publicly opposed mob violence, and even went as far as to declare it to be counterproductive. Ultimately, Samuel Adams and James Otis Jr. organized the first colonial protest against Britain, a boycott of the items taxed by the Sugar Act and Stamp Act. In addition to no longer purchasing the taxed molasses, wine, and fabrics, the colonists also set to work producing their own versions of each, which they could sell without any sort of import duties. Parliament soon realized that it had made a serious mistake in judgment and repealed the Sugar Act and the Stamp Act in 1766. Chapter 3. The Townshend Acts. Not surprisingly, Parliament was not pleased with the colonists' complaints, nor were they about to let a small group of subjects on the other side of the Atlantic deny them what they considered to be their rightful income. So while they repealed the taxes, they also passed the Declaratory Act, primarily in response to the Stamp Congress's Declaration of Rights and Grievances, an act for the better securing the dependency of His Majesty's dominions in America upon the Crown and Parliament of Great Britain. Whereas several of the Houses of Representatives in His Majesty's colonies and plantations in America have of late, against law, claimed to themselves, or to the General Assemblies of the time, the sole and exclusive right of imposing duties and taxes upon His Majesty's subjects in said colonies and plantations, and have, in pursuance of such claim, passed certain votes, resolutions, and orders derogatory to the legislative authority of Parliament, and inconsistent with the dependency of the said colonies and plantations upon the Crown of Great Britain, it may be declared that the said colonies and plantations in America have been, are, and of right ought to be subordinate unto and dependent upon the Imperial Crown and Parliament of Great Britain, and that the King's Majesty, by and with the advice and consent of the Lords Spiritual and Temporal and Commons of Great Britain, in Parliament assembled, had, hath, and of right ought to have full power and authority to make laws and statutes of sufficient force and validity to bind the colonies and people of America, subjects of the Crown of Great Britain in all cases whatsoever. 2. And it be further declared and enacted by the authority aforesaid that all resolutions, votes, orders, and proceedings in any of the said colonies or plantations, whereby the power and authority of the Parliament of Great Britain to make laws and statutes as aforesaid is denied or drawn into question, are, and are hereby declared to be, utterly null and void to all intents and purposes whatsoever. With these words, Parliament made it clear that they had no intention of budging on any issue of concern to the colonists. They further made the first steps towards forcing the issue of American dependence or independence. Things from this point on would have to go one way or the other. To emphasize their determination to remain in charge, they quickly passed the Revenue Act of 1766, which reduced the tax on molasses to a penny a gallon, but applied it to all molasses imports of any kind, be they British or from elsewhere. The following year they added the Townshend Acts, which taxed glass, lead, paint, paper, and perhaps worst of all, tea. As irritating as the tax was, the reason for it was even more offensive. Whereas it is expedient that a revenue should be raised in Your Majesty's dominions in America for making a more certain and adequate provision for defraying the charge of the administration of justice and the support of civil government in such provinces as it shall be found necessary, and towards further defraying the expenses of defending, protecting, and securing the said dominions. Obviously, the problem was that no one in the colonies wanted the British Parliament to administer justice and support the civil government. They wanted to be free to do it themselves. Then there was the issue of how the act would be enforced. Towards this, the act included the following provision: to authorize and empower the officers of His Majesty's Customs to enter and go into any house, warehouse, shop, cellar, or other place in the British colonies or plantations in America, to search for and seize prohibited and uncustomed goods, in the manner directed by the said recited acts, shall and may be granted by the said Superior or Supreme Court of Justice having jurisdiction within such colony or plantation respectively. That was a reference to the dreaded British writ of assistance, which allowed British authorities to conduct general searches of privately owned buildings and homes. Throughout the 1760s, James Otis Jr. forcefully argued against the use of writs of assistance, and it had a profound effect on future leaders of the Revolution. The hatred of the writs of assistance would directly lead to the Fourth Amendment in the Bill of Rights, which prohibited general searches of that type. John Adams would later write, "Otis was a flame of fire, with a promptitude of classical allusions, a depth of research, a rapid summary of historical events and dates, a profusion of legal authorities." Having heard the arguments against the writs of assistance, he would later boldly assert, "The child independence was then and there born. Every man of an immense crowded audience appeared to me to go away as I did, ready to take arms against writs of assistance." Chapter 4. The Arrival of the Redcoats. In addition to the taxing acts, Parliament also passed the Quartering Act of 1765, which obliged citizens in the colonies to quarter British soldiers in inns, barns, or public houses. The purpose of this act was to defray some of the costs of keeping nearly 10,000 British regulars in the colonies permanently after the Seven Years' War. Parliament assumed that the colonial assemblies would construct barracks at their own expense to prevent troops being quartered on private property, but this did not happen. Because of his public and vocal opposition, and also due to suspicions that he was a smuggler, the newly created Customs Board quickly targeted John Hancock, one of the wealthiest merchants in Boston. On April 9, 1768, two tidesmen, custom employees, boarded Hancock's brig Lydia in Boston Harbor. Someone alerted Hancock. Upon arriving at the scene, he found that the agents did not have a writ of assistance. The general search warrant used by the British that allowed them to search an entire property for incriminating evidence. Hancock refused to let them go below deck without a writ of assistance, and when one of the agents managed to get into the ship's hold, Hancock's men forced them back on deck. As a result of Hancock's actions, customs officials wanted to file charges. The case was dropped, however, when Massachusetts Attorney General Jonathan Sewall found that no laws had been broken by Hancock or his men. The incident with the Lydia was only a prelude to what came next. On the evening of May 9, 1768, Hancock's sloop Liberty arrived in Boston Harbor with a ship of Madeira wine. Customs officials inspected the ship the next morning and found only 25 pipes of wine, far below the carrying capacity of the ship. Hancock paid the required duty, but the officials were suspicious and believed that Hancock had arranged to have the bulk of the cargo unloaded the previous night. They had no evidence of this, however, because the two tidesmen swore that nothing had been unloaded. For a time, the matter rested. A month later, however, the matter was resurrected and took a dramatic turn. Unable to force the colonists to pay the hated taxes, the Customs Board requested assistance from the Crown. This came in May 1768 in the form of the HMS Romney, a British warship that pulled into Boston Harbor with 50 cannons on board and men trained in using them. To make his point that he was now in charge, the captain of the Romney began sending his men ashore to force American sailors to the ship and impress them into service. While the British warship HMS Romney was in port, one of the tidesmen who had been on the Liberty changed his story. For reasons that remain unclear to this day, he now claimed that he and his fellow tidesmen had been forcibly held while the ship was illegally unloaded. On June 10th, custom officials seized the Liberty and towed it out to the Romney. This action touched off a riot in Boston that made the earlier violent protests pale by comparison. A contemporary account of the riot was published in the Boston Evening Post on June 20th. This conduct provoked the people who had collected on the shore, and in the dispute, the collector, the comptroller of His Majesty's Customs, and the collector's son were roughly used and pelted with stones, none of them much hurt. The noise brought together a mixed multitude who followed up to the comptroller's house and broke some of his windows, but withdrew by the advice of some prudent gentlemen that interposed. They were joined by a number of sailors and vagrant persons who were suspicious of an intent to put them on board the ship. These went in search for one of the man-of-war's boats. In their way, met with Inspector of Exports and Imports. Him they attacked, broke his sword, and tore his clothes. But by some assistance, he, with difficulty, escaped into a house in King Street. No boat being ashore, between 8 and 9 o'clock, they went to one of the docks and dragged out a large pleasure boat belonging to the collector. This they drew along the street with a loud huzzaing all the way into the common, where they set fire to it and burnt it to ashes. They also broke several windows of the houses of the collector and inspector general, which were nigh the common. No other outrage was committed that night. While no one was killed, the men manning the customs board were duly alarmed, and many of them began to make plans to evacuate their families back to England, with some going as far as to dispatch their wives and children immediately to the cramped safety of the Romney. In the meanwhile, Bernard sent a message to London requesting troops be stationed in Boston to keep order. There was no other violence, but the incident left the people of Boston tense and restless. It was not long before Hancock was hauled into court for two lawsuits arising from the incident. One was a suit against the ship and its contents, filed on June 22nd. As a result, the Liberty was confiscated in August. To add insult to injury, customs officials used the ship to enforce trade regulations until angry colonists in Rhode Island seized the ship and burned it to the waterline. The second trial did not begin until October. In this one, Hancock and five others were charged with allegedly unloading 100 pipes of wine from the Liberty to avoid paying the required duties. If convicted, Hancock and his fellow defendants would have to pay a fine of £9,000, or triple the value of the wine. John Adams, cousin of his political mentor Samuel Adams and his childhood acquaintance, served as his lawyer before the Vice Admiralty Court. This court had no jury and did not always allow for the defense to cross-examine witnesses. The trial dragged out for 5 months, after which the charges against Hancock were dropped with no explanation. As a result of the Liberty affair, the British decided to follow through with an earlier decision to send troops to Boston to suppress the restive city. The original decision had been prompted by the 1768 circular letter authorized by Samuel Adams and approved by the Massachusetts House. The letter had been sent to other colonies to coordinate resistance to the Townshend Acts. After the Liberty riots, Lord Hillsborough, Secretary of State for the Colonies, sent 4 regiments of British regulars to Boston. At the same time, Hillsborough instructed Governor Bernard to order the Massachusetts legislature to revoke the letter. Hancock, along with the rest of the House, voted against rescinding the letter. In response to the pressure from the governor, they drew up a petition demanding his recall. Bernard was removed as governor and returned to England in 1769. The British troops remained, and Boston remained a restive city. In response to the threat of military rule, Samuel insisted that the Boston Town Meeting call for a meeting between all the towns in Boston. Beginning on September 22, 1768, representatives from more than 100 Massachusetts villages and towns met in Faneuil Hall in Boston to plan what to do next. While Samuel pushed for a strong backlash, those around him encouraged a more subtle approach. They agreed on a letter to be sent to the king, insisting that there was no need for troops in Boston because they were loyal and peaceful British subjects who only wanted their voice to be heard. They also pointed out that, according to their charter with the crown, Parliament could not station troops in their towns without their consent. While the letter probably would have made no difference, the answer to that question will never be known. In early October 1768, the first 2 of 4 regiments arrived in town, and their presence only made matters worse as resentment built against the men in the fancy red coats who were courting the local girls and sometimes even taking jobs away from local Bostonians. During this period, Abigail dared not let little Nabby and John play on the front lawn for fear of what they might see or hear. The arrival of British troops enraged Samuel, especially when the officer in charge of the British troops chose to house them in the homes of private citizens at the citizens' own expense. In writing to the Boston Gazette on October 17th, he proclaimed, "Where law ends," says Mr. Locke, "tyranny begins, if the law be transgressed to another's harm. No one, I believe, will deny the truth of the observation, and therefore I again appeal to common sense. Whether the act which provides for the quartering and billeting of the king's troops was not transgressed, when the barracks at the castle, which are sufficient to contain more than the whole number of soldiers now in this town, were absolutely refused. This, I presume, cannot be contested. Should any one say that the law is not transgressed to another's harm, the assertion, I dare say, would contradict the feelings of every sober householder in the town. No man can pretend to say that the peace and good order of the community is so secure with soldiers quartered in the body of a city as without them. Besides, where military power is introduced, military maxims are propagated and adopted, which are inconsistent with and must soon eradicate every idea of civil government. Do we not already find some persons weak enough to believe that an officer is obliged to obey the orders of his superior, though it be even against the law? And let anyone consider whether this doctrine does not directly lead even to the setting up of that superior officer, whoever he may be, as a tyrant. It is, moreover, to be observed that military government and civil are so different from each other, if not opposite, that they cannot long subsist together. Soldiers are not governed properly by the laws of their country, but by a law made for them only. This may in time make them look upon themselves as a body of men different from the rest of the people, and as they and they only have the sword in their hands, they may sooner or later begin to look upon themselves as lords and not the servants of the people, instead of enforcing the execution of law, which, by the way, is far from being the original intent of soldiers, they may refuse to obey it themselves. Nay, they may even make laws for themselves and enforce them by the power of the sword. Such instances are not uncommon in history, and they always will happen when troops are put under the direction of an ambitious or covetous governor. And if there is any reason for fear that this may be the consequence of a transgression of the Act of Parliament, it is a transgression not to the harm of individuals only, but of the public. In addition to numerous letters he wrote to newspapers, journals, and fellow patriots, Samuel also co-authored a number of anonymous articles published in the Journal of Occurrences. The journal published what it claims to be authentic accounts of daily life in Boston during the military occupation, but its publishers were inclined to skew the truth in such a way as to improve circulation. Therefore, the British soldiers were portrayed as power-happy criminals turned loose on an innocent Boston citizenry. However, its biggest story, published on August 1, 1769, was also its last. Governor Bernard left Massachusetts permanently, and the journal ceased publication. Chapter 5. The Boston Massacre. In response to the Townsend Acts, the American colonists continued to organize boycotts against the items being taxed. So one saw more and more houses on the street with broken windows boarded up instead of replaced. Rather than seen as a sign of negligence, this was viewed by neighbors as a sign of patriotism and rebellion against unjust taxes. Likewise, new homes were left unpainted or whitewashed with a mixture of lime and water, while letters were written on the backs of other letters or even on tree bark rather than taxed paper. Of course, the worst deprivation for many was giving up tea. No more brisk fragrance wafting from a breakfast table or a bracing cup following a ride through the cold. But in the name of their rights as Englishmen, the colonies were more than willing to do without even this most cherished vice. At the same time, more and more leaders were coming together to make organized, formal political protests against the taxes. The first of these was a series of 12 letters published by colonial newspapers under the title Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania to the Inhabitants of the British Colonies. Authored by John Dickinson, they were also published in book form and summarized the colonies' grievances against the crown. Dickinson also became one of the first to propose that the differences could rise to the level of separation, though he discouraged that act for the moment. Every government at some time falls into wrong measures. These may proceed from mistake or passion, but every such measure does not dissolve the obligation between the governors and the governed. The mistake may be corrected, the passion may subside. It is the duty of the governed to endeavor to rectify the mistake and to appease the passion. They have not at first any other right than to represent their grievances and to pay for redress, unless an emergency is so pressing as not to allow time for receiving an answer to their applications, which rarely happens. If their applications are disregarded, then that kind of opposition becomes justifiable, which can be made without breaking the laws or disturbing the public peace. This conflicts in the prevention of the oppressors reaping the advantage from their oppressions, and not in their punishment. For experience may teach them what reason did not, and harsh methods cannot be proper until milder ones have failed. If at length it becomes undoubted that an inveterate resolution is formed to annihilate the liberties of the governed, the English history affords frequent examples of resistance by force. What particular circumstances will in any future case justify such resistance can never be ascertained till they happen. Perhaps it may be allowable to say generally that it never can be justifiable until the people are fully convinced that any other submission will be destructive to their happiness. When the appeal is made to the sword, highly probable it is that the punishment will exceed the offense, and the calamities attending on war outweigh those preceding it. These considerations of justice and prudence will always have great influence with good and wise men. At the beginning of 1770, it looked like everything might be resolved peacefully. Parliament, realizing that they weren't going to make any money on items the colonists refused to buy, rescinded most of the Townshend Acts, leaving only the tax on tea in place. The colonists, feeling that they had made their point, called off the boycotts and returned to buying British goods. Within a few months, the British had removed two of the regiments stationed in Boston. However, instead of improving the situation, this placed more strain on those left behind and led to increasing tensions between the soldiers and the colonists. On February 22, 1770, a group of teenagers began throwing stones and rocks at the home of British Customs Officer Ebenezer Richardson, who tried to disperse the teens by firing a shot to scare the crowd. Instead, the bullet mortally wounded a teenager named Christopher Cedar, who was accorded a full funeral procession through Boston, arranged by Samuel Adams himself. Richardson was subsequently convicted of murder, but received a royal pardon and was allowed to continue working as a customs official. Cedar's death heightened tensions across the city, and on the evening of March 5th, another teenager insulted a British officer regarding an overdue payment owed to the shop he was an apprentice at. British soldier Private Hugh White, who was standing guard outside the custom house on King Street, told the teenager to be more respectful. When the teenager began insulting White, White struck him across the head with the butt of his musket. Infuriated by White's assault, a larger group of Bostonians began crowding White and threatening him as he took up a defensive position on the steps of the custom house. A handful of British soldiers, bayonets fixed, marched to the custom house to protect White, and these soldiers found themselves confronted by a mob of hundreds of Bostonians taunting the soldiers and throwing snowballs at them. When one object hit British soldier Private Montgomery, he got back to his feet, shouted, "Damn you, fire!" and fired into the crowd, stunning everyone and nearly killing his own captain, Thomas Preston. With that, several British soldiers began firing into the crowd as well, despite not being ordered to, killing or mortally wounding five people. While the British authorities promised to hold an investigation and the soldiers on the scene were arrested and later tried, the race was on for the Sons of Liberty to memorialize the event. While different portrayals of the event made their way into newspapers, patriot papers accused the British of committing a massacre designed to quell a spirit of liberty. Though the British eventually removed more soldiers from Boston, the primary complaint the colonists had, the damage had already been done. It was Paul Revere who engraved the most famous depiction of the Boston Massacre, even though his rendering has the facts wildly distorted. Evidently working on an earlier engraving made by another artist, Henry Pelham, Revere's engraving was designed for propaganda purposes. In Revere's engraving, Captain Preston is shown ordering his men to fire. The soldiers all fire in unison, and a musket is shooting from the window of the customs house. According to an inflammatory report in the Boston Gazette on March 12, 1770, a few minutes after 9 o'clock, four youths named Edward Archbald, William Merchant, Francis Archbald, and John Leach, Jr. came down Cornhill together, and separating at Dr. Loring's corner, the two former were passing the narrow alley leading to Mr. Murray's barrack, in which was a soldier brandishing a broadsword of an uncommon size against the walls, out of which he struck fire plentifully. A person of mean countenance, armed with a large cudgel, bore him company. Edward Archbald admonished Mr. Merchant to take care of the sword, on which the soldier turned round and struck Archbald on the arm, then pushed at Merchant and pierced through his clothes inside the arm close to the armpit and grazed the skin. Merchant then struck the soldier with a short stick he had, and the other person ran to the barrack and brought with him two soldiers, one armed with a pair of tongs, the other with a shovel. He with the tongs pursued Archbald back through the alley, collared and laid him over the head with the tongs. The noise brought people together, and John Hicks, a young lad coming up, knocked the soldier down, but let him get up again. And more lads gathering drove them back to the barrack where the boys stood some time, as it were, to keep them in. In less than a minute, 10 or 12 of them came out with drawn cutlasses, clubs, and bayonets, and set upon the unarmed boys and young folk who stood them a little while, but finding the inequality of their equipment, dispersed. On hearing the noise, one Samuel Atwood came up to see what was the matter, and entering the alley from Dock Square, heard the latter part of the combat, and when the boys had dispersed, he met the 10 or 12 soldiers aforesaid rushing down the alley towards the square, and asked them if they intended to murder people. They answered, "Yes, by God, root and branch." With that, one of them struck Mr. Atwood with a club, which was repeated by another, and being unarmed, he turned to go off and received a wound on the left shoulder which reached the bone and gave him much pain. Retreating a few steps, Mr. Atwood met two officers and said, "Gentlemen, what is the matter?" They answered, "You'll see, by and by." Immediately after, those heroes appeared in the square, asking, "Where were the boogers? Where were the cowards?" But notwithstanding their fierceness to naked men, one of them advanced towards a youth who had a split of raw stave in his hand, and said, "Damn them, here's one of them." But the young man, seeing a person near him with a drawn sword and good cane ready to support him, held up his stave in defiance, and they quietly passed by him up the little alley by Mr. Silsby's to King Street, where they attacked single and unarmed persons till they raised much clamor, and then turned down Cornhill Street, insulting all they meant in like manner, and pursuing some to their very doors. 30 or 40 persons, mostly lads, being by this means gathered in King Street, Captain Preston, with a party of men with charged bayonets, came from the main guard to the commissioner's house, the soldiers pushing their bayonets, crying, "Make way!" They took place by the custom house, and continuing to push to drive people off, pricked some in several places, on which they were clamorous, and, it is said, threw snowballs. On this, the captain commanded them to fire, and more snowballs coming, he said, "Damn you, fire! Be the consequence what it will." One soldier then fired, and a townsman with a cudgel struck him over the hands with such force that he dropped his firelock, and rushing forward, aimed a blow at the captain's head, which grazed his hat and fell pretty heavy upon his arm. However, the soldiers continued the fire successively, till 7 or 8, or some say 11, guns were discharged. By this fatal maneuver, 3 men were laid dead on the spot, and 2 more struggling for life. But what showed a degree of cruelty unknown to British troops, at least since the House of Hanover has directed their operation, was an attempt to fire upon or push with their bayonets the persons who undertook to remove the slain and wounded. Mr. Benjamin Lee, now an undertaker in the Delft manufactory, came up, and after some conversation with Captain Preston relative to his conduct in this affair, advised him to draw off his men, with which he complied. Using the event as leverage, Hancock and Adams demanded the troops' removal, meeting with Governor Thomas Hutchinson and the British commander of Boston, Colonel William Dalrymple. Hancock made the incredible claim that there were 10,000 armed colonists ready to march on Boston if the troops remained. While Hutchinson knew Hancock was bluffing, the new governor was a realist. The British troops were in an untenable position in the town. Thus, Colonel Dalrymple agreed to move his regiments from the town to Castle William. Boston celebrated Hancock and Adams as heroes for getting the troops removed, and both would shortly be re-elected to the Massachusetts House. Then, wanting to show American jurisprudence in its best light, Samuel persuaded his own cousin John to defend the soldiers charged. He assumed that he was safe in supporting a fair trial, since, in his mind, all the men were obviously guilty of murder. Adams based his defense not on the politics of Great Britain, nor on the character of the men involved, but on the testimony of eyewitnesses. In what may have been his finest judicial hour, Adams argued that there was no evidence to indicate that any command to fire had been given, leading to the acquittal of the British commander. He then went on to show that not all the soldiers there that day had fired, famously pointing out, "Facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passion, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence." 6 of the 8 soldiers he represented were acquitted, 2 were convicted and branded on their thumbs, and the entire incident was put to rest with no further violence. On the 3rd anniversary of the massacre, John wrote, "The part I took in defense of Captain Preston and the soldiers procured me anxiety and obloquy enough. It was, however, one of the most gallant, generous, manly, and disinterested actions of my whole life, and one of the best pieces of service I ever rendered my country. Judgment of death against those soldiers would have been as foul a stain upon this country as the executions of the Quakers or witches anciently. As the evidence was, the verdict of the jury was exactly right. This, however, is no reason why the town should not call the action of that night a massacre, nor is it any argument in favor of the governor or minister who caused them to be sent here. but it is the strongest proofs of the danger of standing armies. Though John was worried taking the case would hurt him within the community, the case made John famous, and his practice soared after he successfully got most of the British redcoats acquitted. In response to what he perceived to be the miscarriage of justice, Samuel wrote a series of letters to a London newspaper in which he basically retried the already acquitted men in the press. The following, signed Vindex, like the others, gives a sense of his tone. If all these things were done by the soldiers before the people offered them any injury, I would ask who made the first assault. If there was an unlawful assembly, who were they? Were the people the unlawful assembly, who were collected together, some from an apprehension of fire in the town, and with the necessary preparations, engines and buckets, to have extinguished it, if there had been one, others from the more alarming apprehension that the soldiers had issued from the barracks, as indeed they had done, and that agreeable to their threatenings many days before, and their correspondent behavior on that very evening, they were massacring the inhabitants? Were they who bore all that insolent and irritating language from the soldiers as they marched from the main guard, and before they formed at the custom house, who were pushed at, struck with bayonets, and wounded, to be charged with being the aggressors, because they finally, when they saw them bent upon firing against repeated warnings, took such methods as their understanding dictated to them, in the midst of such a scene, to prevent their committing so rash an act which it was the duty as well as the professed design of their officer to have prevented, and which in the opinion of some he might have prevented if he would, and yet we find a person of high rank and figure in this province testifying in court in the case of Captain Preston, that such was his opinion of the prudence of this same officer, that he should have chosen him out to have commanded upon a like occasion. Despite the results of the trial, and the fact that what came out at trial was not nearly as damning as the Gazette's reporting, the damage was already done, and the colonists were spoiling for a fight. 2 years later, when the British ship Gaspy was attacked just off the shore of Providence, Rhode Island, the colonists were even more furious to learn that the Crown was offering a reward for the capture of the men involved, and also planning to send them to England to be tried, rather than having them be arraigned in America, as was the custom. Chapter 6. The Boston Tea Party. Shortly after the Boston Massacre, Samuel Adams and his allies organized a group of committees of correspondence. In each town, a group of men would be chosen to consult together over the current political situation, and then to communicate their thoughts to others in the colony via messenger. The system worked so well in Massachusetts that other colonies soon followed suit. The colonies' committees eventually began coordinating responses to British acts with each other, forming the first political bonds between separate colonies, and they would be the bodies that brought about the first Continental Congress in the summer of 1774. In one of the first letters sent, Samuel enclosed an essay entitled The Rights of Colonists as Men. In it, he gave voice to several of John Locke's principles, which would also eventually find their way into the Declaration of Independence. Among the natural rights of the colonists are these. First, a right to life. Secondly, to liberty. Thirdly, to property, together with the right to support and defend them in the best manner they can. These are evident branches of, rather than deductions from, the duty of self-preservation, commonly called the first law of nature. All men have a right to remain in a state of nature as long as they please, and in case of intolerable oppression, civil or religious, to leave the society they belong to and enter into another. When men enter into society, it is by voluntary consent, and they have a right to demand and insist upon the performance of such conditions and previous limitations as form an equitable original compact. Every natural right not expressly given up, or from the nature of a social compact necessarily ceded, remains. All positive and civil laws should conform, as far as possible, to the law of natural reason and equity. In an attempt to rein in the committee, Governor Hutchinson spoke publicly to the legislature in January of 1773 and put forth the argument that denying Parliament's authority over any portion of the British Empire was an act similar to rebellion. However, when Samuel, speaking on behalf of his fellow House members, reminded the governor that the Massachusetts Charter was a legal document between the king and the colony alone, Hutchinson was forced to back down. Their written discussions were later published by the committee in the Boston Pamphlet, and the period of peace soon came to an end. Another issue arose in 1772, the so-called Letters Affair. In 1772, letters written by Hutchinson between 1767 and 1769 to Thomas Whately in Britain, somehow came into the possession of Benjamin Franklin, at the time a colonial agent in London. Franklin sent the letters to Thomas Cushing, the Massachusetts Speaker of the House, and eventually the letters fell into the hands of Boston's Patriots. Together, Hancock and Adams were instrumental in their publication in June 1773. The letters caused a firestorm. In them, Hutchinson recommended that there should be, in the colonies, an abridgment of what are called English liberties. The letters were reprinted in the colonies, and Hutchinson was burned in effigy during one protest in Philadelphia. In the turmoil that followed, the Massachusetts House petitioned for the removal of Hutchinson from office, and in turn, Hutchinson requested permission to come to England. In this atmosphere came word of the Parliament's passage of the Tea Act of 1773. The Tea Act was designed to shore up the East India Company, one of Britain's most important commercial interests. It gave the company the rights to sell directly to the colonies without having to go through the brokers that other companies did, creating the potential for the serious economic misfortune for colonial tea merchants. This action cut colonial merchants such as Hancock out of the company's supply chain and undercut the price of smuggled Dutch tea. Despite rumors to the contrary, the colonists were not as angry about the cost of the tax on the tea as they were the tax itself. In fact, the tea being brought in would be less expensive than that being sold. The problem was that Parliament was once again taking it upon itself to regulate colonial trade without the colonists' permission, and they felt that, if they purchased the cheaper tea being offered, they were, in effect, giving in to parliamentary rule. Ironically, every other colony was able to get the boats loaded with tea to return to England with their cargo. However, Governor Hutchinson, still smarting over the House's attempts to have him removed, stood firm. The fact that two of those most invested in the tea in the harbor were his own sons no doubt also contributed to his commitment. On November 5th, Hancock was elected as moderator at a Boston town meeting that resolved that anyone who supported the Tea Act was an enemy to America. Still, Hancock and others were unsuccessful in forcing the resignation of the agents appointed to receive the tea shipments, as had happened in other colonies. Hutchinson was determined to stand his ground and see that Parliament's wishes were enforced. As the tea ship Dartmouth arrived in Boston Harbor in late November, Paul Revere and Dr. Joseph Warren organized the North End Caucus to make sure that the tea would not be unloaded. Meanwhile, in the face of Hutchinson's opposition, Samuel and his allies contacted other Massachusetts committees of correspondence and arranged a mass meeting at Faneuil Hall on November 29th. By this time, the Dartmouth had arrived with a hull full of tea. The meeting, which drew thousands, had to be moved to the Old South Meeting House. There it was agreed that 25 men would take turns watching the ship and making sure it was not unloaded, while the rest of the committee members continued to pressure the ship's captain to return to England as his fellows had. According to one anonymous visitor to Boston at that time, having accidentally arrived at Boston upon a visit to a friend the evening before the meeting of the body of the people on the 29th of November, curiosity and the pressing invitations of my most kind host induced me to attend the meeting. I must confess that I was most agreeably, and I hope that I shall be forgiven by the people if I say so, unexpectedly, entertained and instructed by the regular, reasonable, and sensible conduct and expression of the people there collected, that I should rather have entertained an idea of being transported to the British Senate than to an adventurous and promiscuous assembly of people of a remote colony. Were I not convinced by the genuine and uncorrupted integrity and manly hardihood of the rhetoricians of that assembly that they were not yet corrupted by venality or debauched by luxury. The conduct of that wise and considerate body, in their several transactions, evidently tended to preserve the property of the East India Company. I must confess I was very disagreeably affected with the conduct of Mr. Hutchinson, their pensioned governor, on the succeeding day, who very unreasonably, and, as I am informed, very arbitrarily, not having the sanction of the law, framed and executed a mandate to disperse the people, which, in my opinion, with a people less prudent and temperate, would have cost him his head. The force of that body was directed to effect the return of the teas to Great Britain. Much argument was expended, much entreaty was made use of to effect this desirable purpose. Mr. Roch of Dartmouth behaved, in my estimation, very unexceptionably. His disposition was seemingly to comport with the desires of the people to convey the teas to the original proprietors. The consignees have behaved like scoundrels in refusing to take the consignment or indemnify the owner of the ship which conveyed this detestable commodity to this port. Every possible step was taken to preserve this property. The people, being exasperated with the conduct of the administration in this affair, great pains were taken, and much policy exerted to procure the stated watch for this purpose. The body of the people determined the tea should not be landed. The determination was deliberate, was judicious. The sacrifice of their rights, of the union of all the colonies, would have been the effect had they conducted with less resolution. On the Committee of Correspondence, they devolved the care of seeing their resolutions seasonably executed. That body, as I have been informed by one of their members, had taken every step prudence and patriotism could suggest to effect the desirable purpose, but were defeated. According to George Hughes, a Boston shoemaker and one of the few participants who left a written account of the Tea Party, after one meeting with colonists, Governor Hutchinson publicly declared that if the rebels, as they were pleased to style the Bostonians, should not withdraw their opposition to the landing of the tea before a certain day, the 17th day of December, 1773, they should on that day force it on shore, under the cover of their cannon's mouth. With Governor Hutchinson refusing to allow the Dartmouth, or the other two ships that soon joined in, to leave without paying their prescribed import duty, the standoff continued until December 16th, the day before Hutchinson's deadline to unload the tea. Hughes explained the beginning of that fateful day. On the day preceding the 17th, there was a meeting of the citizens of the County of Suffolk, convened at one of the churches in Boston, for the purpose of consulting on what measures might be considered expedient to prevent the landing of the tea, or secure the people from the collection of the duty. At that meeting, a committee was appointed to wait on Governor Hutchinson, and request him to inform them whether he would take any measures to satisfy the people on the object of the meeting. To the first application of this committee, the governor told them he would give them a definite answer by 5 o'clock in the afternoon. As 5 p.m. approached, Samuel Adams arranged another meeting at the Old South Meeting House, where a crowd of nearly 7,000 gathered to await Hutchinson's response. They would not get the response they were seeking from Hutchinson. Hughes explained, "At the hour appointed, the committee again repaired to the governor's house, and on inquiry found he had gone to his county seat at Milton, a distance of about 6 miles. The anonymous spectator who wrote about the events of November 27th also claimed to be at the Old South Meeting House that afternoon and described the scene. The body once more assembled, I was again present. Such a collection of the people was to me a novelty. Near 7,000 persons from several towns, gentlemen, merchants, yeomen, and others, respectable for their rank and abilities, and venerable for their age and character, constituted the assembly. They decently, unanimously, and firmly adhered to their former resolution that the baleful commodity which was to rivet and establish the duty should never be landed. To prevent the mischief, they repeated the desires of the committee to the towns, that the owner of the ship should apply for a clearance. It appeared that Mr. Roch had been managed, and was still under the influence of the opposite party. He resisted the request of the people to apply for a clearance for his ship, with an obstinacy which, in my opinion, bordered on stubbornness. Subdued at length by the peremptory demand of the body, he consented to apply. A committee of 10 respectable gentlemen were appointed to attend him to the collector, the body meeting the same morning by adjournment. Mr. Roch was directed to protest in form, and then apply to the governor for a pass by the castle, giving him permission to leave the harbor. Mr. Roch executed his commission with fidelity, but a pass could not be obtained. His Excellency excusing himself in his refusal that he should not make the precedent of granting a pass till a clearance was obtained, which was indeed a fallacy, as it had been usual with him in ordinary cases. Mr. Roch, returning in the evening, reported as above. The body then voted his conduct to be satisfactory, and recommending order and regularity to the people, dissolved. While the Boston Gazette gives a slightly different account, it still confirms the fact that the colonists tried, to the very end, to have the tea legally returned, and that the governor clearly refused to allow this. On Tuesday last, the body of the people of this and all the adjacent towns, and others from the distance of 20 miles, assembled at the Old South Meeting House to inquire the reason of the delay in sending the ship Dartmouth with the East India tea back to London. and having found that the owner had not taken the necessary steps for that purpose, they enjoined him, at his peril, to demand of the collector of the customs a clearance for the ship, and appointed a committee of 10 to see it performed, after which they adjourned to the Thursday following 10 o'clock. They then met, and being informed by Mr. Roch that a clearance was refused him, they enjoined him immediately to enter a protest to apply to the governor for a passport by the castle, and adjourned again till 3 o'clock for the same day, at which time they again met, and after waiting till near sunset, Mr. Roch came in, and informed them that he had accordingly entered his protest, and waited on the governor for a pass. But His Excellency told him he could not, consistent with his duty, grant it until the vessel was qualified. The people, finding all their efforts to preserve the property of the East India Company and return it to London, frustrated by the sea of consignees, the collector of the customs, and the governor of the province, dissolved their meeting. There is still historical disagreement over whether Adams intended to have the meeting at the Old South Meeting House dissolved. When it was clear that Hutchinson was gone, and the issue would not be resolved, Hancock is reported to have told the crowd, "Let every man do what is right in his own eyes." Meanwhile, Samuel Adams told the crowd, "This meeting can do nothing further to save the country." British loyalists and some historians would later claim that Adams's statement was an intentional signal meant to touch off the Boston Tea Party. But as people began filing out, Adams tried in vain to get control of the crowd again so the meeting could continue. Far from being the puppet master controlling the mob, it seems Adams was powerless to stop it. It is at this point that the facts and legends about the Boston Tea Party begin to skew. According to Hughes, after the people at Old South Meeting House learned about the absence of Hutchinson, there was a confused murmur among the members, and the meeting was immediately dissolved, many of them crying out, "Let every man do his duty, and be true to his country," and there was a general huzzah for Griffin's Wharf. Hughes then described the Boston Tea Party itself. "It was now evening, and I immediately dressed myself in the costume of an Indian, equipped with a small hatchet, which I and my associates denominated the tomahawk, with which, and a club, after having painted my face and hands with coal dust in the shop of a blacksmith, I repaired to Griffin's Wharf, where the ships lay that contained the tea. When I first appeared in the street, after being thus disguised, I fell in with many who were dressed, equipped, and painted as I was, and who fell in with me and marched in order to the place of our destination. When we arrived at the wharf, there were 3 of our number who assumed an authority to direct our operations, to which we readily submitted. They divided us into 3 parties for the purpose of boarding the 3 ships which contained the tea at the same time. The name of him who commanded the division to which I was assigned was Leonard Pitt. The names of the other commanders I never knew. We were immediately ordered by the respective commanders to board all the ships at the same time, which we promptly obeyed. The commander of the division to which I belonged, as soon as we were on board the ship, appointed me boatswain, and ordered me to go to the captain and demand of him the keys to the hatches and 12 candles. I made the demand accordingly, and the captain promptly replied and delivered the articles, but requested me at the same time to do no damage to the ship or rigging. We then were ordered by our commander to open the hatches and take out all the chests of tea and throw them overboard, and we immediately proceeded to execute his orders, first cutting and splitting the chests with our tomahawks, so as thoroughly to expose them to the effects of the water. In about 3 hours from the time we went on board, we had thus broken and thrown aboard every tea chest to be found in the ship, while those in the other ships were disposing of the tea in the same way, at the same time. We were surrounded by British armed ships, but no attempt was made to resist us. We then quietly retired to our several places of residence, without having any conversation with each other, or taking any measures to discover who were our associates. Nor do I recollect our having had the knowledge of the name of a single individual concerned in that affair, except that of Leonard Pitt, the commander of my division, whom I have mentioned. There appeared to be an understanding that each individual should volunteer his services, keep his own secret, and risk the consequence for himself. No disorder took place during that transaction, and it was observed at that time that the stillest night ensued that Boston had enjoyed for many months. During the time we were throwing the tea overboard, there were several attempts made by some of the citizens of Boston and its vicinity to carry off small quantities of it for their family use. To effect that object, they would watch their opportunity to snatch up a handful from the deck, where it became plentifully scattered, and put it into their pockets. One Captain O'Connor, whom I well knew, came on board for that purpose, and when he supposed he was not noticed, filled his pockets and also the lining of his coat. But I had detected him and gave information to the captain of what he was doing. We were ordered to take him into custody, and just as he was stepping from the vessel, I seized him by the skirt of his coat, and in attempting to pull him back, tore it off. But springing forward by a rapid effort, he made his escape. He had, however, to run a gauntlet through the crowd, upon the wharf, 9 each one, as he passed, giving him a kick or a stroke. Another attempt was made to save a little tea from the ruins of the cargo by a tall, aged man who wore a large cocked hat and a white wig, which was fashionable at that time. He had slightly slipped a little into his pocket, but being detected, they seized him, and taking his hat and wig from his head, threw them, together with the tea, of which they had emptied his pockets, into the water. In consideration of his advanced age, he was permitted to escape, with now and then a slight kick. The next morning, after we had cleared the ships of tea, it was discovered that very considerable quantities of it were floating upon the surface of the water, and to prevent the possibility of any of its being saved for use, a number of small boats were manned by sailors and citizens, who rowed them into those parts of the harbor wherever the tea was visible, and beating it with oars and paddles, so thoroughly drenched it as to render its entire destruction inevitable. By and large, that is how the Boston Tea Party is still most commonly depicted. But like every other account written or published by someone purporting to have participated in the dumping of the tea on December 16, 1773, Hughes wrote his account about 50 years after the Boston Tea Party. By comparing it to newspaper accounts that were published immediately after the Tea Party, and other private accounts written by individuals decades later, it's apparent that there are stunning discrepancies in the accounts. Hughes describes the crowd as filing out of the Old South Meeting House and heading directly to Griffin's Wharf, but this is likely inaccurate. It's still unclear whether the Boston Tea Party was planned by the leaders of the meeting, whether it had been plotted by others beforehand, or whether it was an impromptu event. The destruction of the tea was discussed at the Old South Meeting House. One man at the meetings, not known for his patriotic sentiments, named John Rowe, asked whether salt water would make as good tea as fresh. But the Tea Party has been described as being conducted by anywhere from 30 to 130 individuals, most of whom took pains to disguise their faces. If thousands of people were at the Old South Meeting House, the vast majority did not head to Boston Harbor that night. Moreover, the fact that people disguised themselves meant there was never any certainty as to who actually participated. Naturally, in the aftermath of the Revolution, once it became clear how important the Tea Party had been, every Bostonian in the 19th century was happy to take credit for dumping the tea. This is made evident by the fact that accounts written by those claiming to have participated contradict each other on what should have been the most obvious details, including the number of people involved at the time of the Tea Party itself. As the report of the Boston Gazette indicates, the full ramifications and importance of the Boston Tea Party were not immediately clear, as evidenced by the rather short shrift given to the act itself. On Tuesday last, the body of the people of this and all the adjacent towns, and others from the distance of 20 miles, assembled at the Old South Meeting House to inquire the reason of the delay in sending the ship Dartmouth with the East India tea back to London, and having found that the owner had not taken the necessary steps for that purpose, they enjoined him, at his peril, to demand of the collector of the customs a clearance for the ship, and appointed a committee of 10 to see it performed, after which they adjourned to the Thursday following 10 o'clock. They then met, and being informed by Mr. Roch that a clearance was refused him, they enjoined him immediately to enter a protest to apply to the governor for a passport by the castle, and adjourned again till 3 o'clock for the same day, at which time they again met, and after waiting till near sunset, Mr. Roch came in, and informed them that he had accordingly entered his protest, and waited on the governor for a pass. But His Excellency told him he could not, consistent with his duty, grant it until the vessel was qualified. The people, finding all their efforts to preserve the property of the East India Company and return it to London, frustrated by the sea of consignees, the collector of the customs, and the governor of the province, dissolved their meeting. But behold what followed. A number of brave and resolute men, determined to do all in their power to save their country from the ruin which their enemies had plotted, in less than 4 hours, emptied every chest of tea on board the three ships commanded by the captains Hall, Bruce, and Coffin, amounting to 342 chests, into the sea, without the least damage done to the ships or any other property. The matters and owners are well pleased that their ships are thus cleared, and the people are almost universally congratulating each other on this happy event. That article made no mention of one of the most famous details of the Tea Party, the use of Native American disguises. On the other hand, the anonymous account published in the Gazette a few days later claimed that people showed up in Native American disguises before the crowd at the Old South Meeting House dispersed. Just before the dissolution of the meeting, a number of brave and resolute men dressed in the Indian manner approached near the door of the assembly, gave the war whoop, which rang through the house and was answered by some in the galleries, but silence being commanded, and a peaceable deportment was again enjoyed till the dissolution. The Indians, as they were then called, repaired to the wharf where the ships lay that had the tea on board, and were followed by hundreds of people to see the event of the transactions of those who made so grotesque an appearance. They, the Indians, immediately repaired on board Captain Hall's ship, where they hoisted out the chests of tea, and when upon deck, stove the chests and emptied the tea overboard. Having cleared the ship, they proceeded to Captain Bruce's, and then to Captain Coffin's brig. They applied themselves so dexterously to the destruction of this commodity, that in the space of 3 hours they broke up 342 chests, which was the whole number in those vessels, and discharged the contents into the dock. When the tide rose, it floated the broken chests and the tea in so much that the surface of the water was filled therewith a considerable way from the south part of the town to Dorchester Neck, and lodged on the shores. There was the greatest care taken to prevent the tea from being purloined by the populace. One or two, being detected in endeavoring to pocket a small quantity, were stripped of their acquisitions and very roughly handled. It is worthy of remark that although a considerable quantity of goods were still remaining on board the vessels, no injury was sustained. Such attention to private property was observed that a small padlock belonging to the captain of one of the ships being broke, another was procured and sent to him. The town was very quiet during the whole evening and the night following. Those persons who were from the country returned with a merry heart, and the next day joy appeared in almost every countenance, some on occasion of the destruction of the tea, others on account of the quietness with which it was effected. One of the Monday's papers said that the masters and owners are well pleased that their ships are thus cleared. Hughes claimed that the people in the Old South Meeting House generally made their way toward the Dartmouth in Griffin's Wharf, but the first published account by a man claiming to have participated, Joshua Wyeth, suggests that the vast majority of people at the Old South Meeting House had no clue the Tea Party was going to take place. I had but a few hours' warning of what was intended to be done. To prevent discovery, we agreed to wear ragged clothes and disfigure ourselves, dressing to resemble Indians. Our most intimate friends among the spectators had not the least knowledge of us. At the appointed hour, we met in an old building at the wharf, and fell in one after another, as if by accident, as not to excite suspicion. We placed a sentry at the end of the wharf, another in the middle, and one on the bow of each ship as we took possession. We boarded the ship moored by the wharf, and ordered the captain and crew to open the hatchways, and hand us the hoisting tackle and rope, assuring them that no harm was intended them. Some of our number then jumped into the hold and passed the chests to the tackle. As they were hauled on deck, others knocked them open with axes, and others raised them to the railings and discharged their contents overboard. All who were not needed on this ship went on board the others, where the same ceremonies were repeated. We were merry, in an undertone, at the idea of making so large a cup of tea for the fishes, but we used not more words than absolutely necessary. I never worked harder in my life. While we were unloading, the people collected in great numbers about the wharf to see what was going on. They crowded around us. Our sentries were not armed, and could not stop any who insisted on passing. Perhaps the most surprising discrepancy among the accounts is that they wildly vary on the number of participants. An account of the Tea Party that was written based off experiences of David Kingston, another man claiming to have taken part, stated, "They repaired to Boston, where they were joined by others, and 24 disguised as Indians hastened on board, 12 armed with muskets and bayonets, the rest with tomahawks and clubs, having first agreed, whatever might be the result, to stand by each other to the last, and that the first man who faltered should be knocked on the head and thrown over the tea. They expected to have a fight, and did not doubt that an effort would be made for their arrest. But, in the language of the old man, we cared no more for our lives than three straws, and determined to throw the tea overboard. We were all captains, and every one commanded himself. They pledged themselves in no event, while it should be dangerous to do so, to reveal the names of the party, a pledge which was faithfully observed until the War of the Revolution was brought to a successful issue. However, one spectator named John Andrews counted a considerably larger number of participants, and unlike Hughes, who claimed that men were divided into three groups by authorities at the wharf, Andrews claimed they already knew their roles before reaching the wharf and boarded the ships in a remarkably orderly fashion. The Indians mustered, I'm told, upon Fort Hill, to the number of about 200, and proceeded two by two to Griffin's Wharf, where Hall, Bruce, and Coffin's vessels lay. Coffin's ship had arrived at the wharf only the day before, and was freighted with a large quantity of other goods, which they took the greatest care not to injure in the least. Before 9 o'clock in the evening, every chest on board the three vessels was knocked to pieces and flung over the sides. They say the actors were Indians from Narragansett. Whether they were or not, to a transient observer, they appeared such. They were clothed in blankets, with their heads muffled and copper-colored faces. Each was armed with a hatchet or axe or pair of pistols, nor was their dialect different from what I imagine the real Indians to speak, as their jargon was nonsense to all but themselves. One thing that the leaders of the protest feared was that their actions would be construed by those around them as nothing more than theft and looting. In order to prevent even the rumor of such wrongdoing, they went out of their way to severely punish anyone caught taking any of the tea for himself. During the time we were throwing the tea overboard, there were several attempts made by some of the citizens of Boston and its vicinity to carry off small quantities of it for their family use. To effect that object, they would watch their opportunity to snatch up a handful from the deck, where it became plentifully scattered, and put it into their pockets. One Captain O'Connor, whom I well knew, came on board for that purpose, and when he supposed he was not noticed, filled his pockets and also the lining of his coat. But I had detected him and gave information to the captain of what he was doing. We were ordered to take him into custody, and just as he was stepping from the vessel, I seized him by the skirt of his coat, and in attempting to pull him back, tore it off. But springing forward by a rapid effort, he made his escape. He had, however, to run a gauntlet through the crowd, upon the wharf, 9 each one, as he passed, giving him a kick or a stroke. Another attempt was made to save a little tea from the ruins of the cargo by a tall, aged man who wore a large cocked hat and a white wig, which was fashionable at that time. He had slightly slipped a little into his pocket, but being detected, they seized him, and taking his hat and wig from his head, threw them, together with the tea, of which they had emptied his pockets, into the water. In consideration of his advanced age, he was permitted to escape, with now and then a slight kick. The next morning, after we had cleared the ships of tea, it was discovered that very considerable quantities of it were floating upon the surface of the water, and to prevent the possibility of any of its being saved for use, a number of small boats were manned by sailors and citizens, who rowed them into those parts of the harbor wherever the tea was visible, and beating it with oars and paddles, so thoroughly drenched it as to render its entire destruction inevitable. So what exactly happened? It seems likely that some of the Sons of Liberty and other circles of Bostonians decided ahead of time to dump the tea if an agreement wasn't reached, and in order to avoid being identified, some of them disguised their faces, whether as Native Americans or not, in the hopes of avoiding reprisal from British authorities. That ruse certainly worked, because even today, historians are left to speculate who actually participated in the Tea Party. Among the well-known patriots, it's believed that Paul Revere participated, and Dr. Joseph Warren, a friend of Revere's, and one of the patriot leaders, may have as well. The extent of Samuel Adams' participation in the Boston Tea Party is still debated among historians. One of the reasons he is so associated with the Tea Party is that a biography written by his own great-grandson credited him with organizing the Tea Party and giving the signal to proceed with the quote that nothing more could be done. But other eyewitnesses claim nobody left until 15 minutes after his announcement, and it's still unclear whether he even witnessed the Tea Party. While Samuel Adams may or may not have had anything to do with planning the event, he certainly worked hard to publicize it to the other colonies. In a letter to a friend, he wrote, "The people, finding all their endeavors for this purpose thus totally frustrated, dissolved the meeting, which had consisted by common estimation of at least 7,000 men, many of whom had come from towns at the distance of 20 miles. In less than 4 hours, every chest of tea on board three ships which had by this time arrived, 342 chests, or rather the contents of them, was thrown into the sea without the least injury to the vessels or any other property. Hancock was not a direct participant in the Boston Tea Party, but he expressed his understanding in a December 21, 1773 letter to his London agents. "We have been much agitated in consequence of the arrival of the tea ships by the East India Company, and after every effort was made to induce the consignees to return it from whence it came, and all proving ineffectual, in a very few hours the whole of the tea was thrown into the salt water. Philadelphia and York are determined the tea shall not land. No one circumstance could possibly have taken place more effectively to unite the colonies than this maneuver of the tea. It is universally resented here, and all people of all ranks detest the measure." Chapter 7. The First Continental Congress. Infuriated by the Tea Party, the British Parliament passed a new set of stringent and punitive laws known collectively as the Coercive Acts. The first of these closed the port of Boston to both coming and going ships, in effect crippling the city's economy until the city repaid the merchants for their lost tea. The second basically invalidated the Massachusetts Charter and gave Parliament the right to appoint colonial officials previously elected by their peers. Next, the Administration of Justice Act authorized judges to remove any colonist charged with a crime to another colony, or even Great Britain, for trial. The final and most severe blow, however, came when Governor Hutchinson was removed and replaced with General Thomas Gage, commander of the British forces in America, placing the city under unofficial martial law. With the Coercive or Intolerable Acts of 1774, Parliament hoped the punitive measures would compel the colonies to stop resisting parliamentary authority. Like the other attempts, however, this one only had the opposite effect, with many colonists viewing the acts as an arbitrary violation of their rights. As always, Samuel Adams was at the head of the colonial response to these perceived political atrocities. He led the Boston Town Meeting in organizing a boycott of all British goods and proposed that it was time for all the colonies to meet together to take collective action against England. In addition to selling silver, pulling teeth, and engraving political artwork, Paul Revere took on another task that would be essential for the formation of the First Continental Congress. "In the year 1773, I was employed by the select men of the town of Boston to carry the account of the destruction of the tea to New York, and afterwards, 1774, to carry their dispatches to New York and Philadelphia for calling a Congress, and afterwards to Congress, several times in the fall of 1774 and the winter of 1775, I was one of upwards of 30, chiefly mechanics, who formed ourselves into a committee for the purpose of watching the movements of the British soldiers and gaining every intelligence of the movement of the Tories. We held our meetings at the Green Dragon Tavern. We were so careful that our meetings should be kept secret that every time we met, every person swore upon the Bible that they would not discover any of our transactions. But to Messrs. John Hancock, Sam Adams, Doctors Warren, Church, and one or two more." During the years of 1774 and 1775, Revere would make at least 18 of these trips. In fact, they became so commonplace that newspapers in the colonies even carried reports of them. However, he was shocked when a cousin wrote him from England to say that he'd seen reports of his activities in a London newspaper, where he had accurately been identified as an express courier for the colonists. Clearly, the Sons of Liberty and British authorities were engaged in an unofficial intelligence war, with well-placed spies and moles helping report each side's plans and actions to the other. As it turned out, the British spy was Benjamin Church, something the Patriots came to suspect, but could not prove at the outbreak of the Revolution. Church's role as a British spy would not be confirmed until about a century after the Revolution, when scholars began going through British General Thomas Gage's private papers. Among his most famous trips was the Portsmouth Alarm, when he rode from Boston to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, in December of 1774, to inform the militia there that word had reached Boston of an imminent British landing in the port. Though the rumors of the landing proved to be false, the event still provoked the militia to attack Fort William and Mary and make off with most of its supply of gunpowder. The Portsmouth Alarm and the Cambridge Powder Alarm in late 1774 demonstrated a number of important things. First, it showed that the British authorities essentially maintained no control over the countryside outside of major population centers, and it demonstrated the speed with which colonists were capable of relaying messages and organizing for potential war. Revere was but one messenger for one committee. In fact, committees like these spread out across all the colonies, and it was through these circles that patriots across the American colonies communicated with each other and would form a united response to what they considered British transgressions. When Samuel Adams and the Bostonians communicated with a committee in New York to suggest a boycott, New York's Committee of 51, dominated by merchants, suggested a different idea. Upon these reasons, we conclude that a Congress of deputies from the colonies in general is of the utmost moment, that it ought to be assembled without delay, and some unanimous resolution formed in its fatal emergency, not only respecting your deplorable circumstances, but for the security of our common rights. Rather than rid themselves of representative government, the Intolerable Act unintentionally created the first representative body utilized by almost all the colonies, the First Continental Congress. Samuel and John were two of five delegates secretly elected by the Massachusetts legislature to attend the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia in September 1774. Hancock, however, was not a delegate to the First Continental Congress. Possibly it was for health reasons, but it could have been that Hancock would remain in charge while other leaders were in Philadelphia. Around the same time, because of his public role in the Patriot movement, Gage dismissed Hancock from his post as colonel of the Boston Cadets. For Samuel, the trip to Philadelphia must have been surreal. He had never been outside Massachusetts, and indeed had rarely left Boston. Now he found himself rubbing shoulders with the great minds in the colonies, including men like Thomas Jefferson. While he came from a wealthy background himself, he'd lost most of his money through neglected business ventures, and was even wearing a suit of clothes purchased for him by sympathetic friends. Working with others who shared his views but had, perhaps, taken more time to clearly think them through, had a salutatory effect on Samuel, causing him to step back and review what he really believed made the colonies great. He wrote to a friend during the first months of the Congress, "There are virtues and vices which are properly called political. Corruption, dishonesty to one's country, luxury, and extravagance tend to be the ruin of states. The opposite virtues tend to their establishment. But there is a connection between vices as well as virtues, and one opens the door for the entrance of another. Therefore, wise and able politicians will guard against other vices, and be attentive to promote every virtue. He who is void of virtuous attachments in private life is, or very soon will be, void of all regard for his country. There is seldom an instance of a man guilty of betraying his country who had not before lost the feeling of moral obligation in his private connections. Before Dr. Benjamin Church Jr. was detected of holding a criminal correspondence with the enemies of his country, his infidelity to his wife had been notorious. Since private and public vices are in reality, though not always apparently, so nearly connected, of how much importance, how necessary is it that the utmost pains be taken by the public to have the principles of virtue early inculcated on the minds even of children, and the moral sense kept alive, and that the wise institutions of our ancestors for these great purposes be encouraged by the government. For no people will tamely surrender their liberties, nor can any be easily subdued, when knowledge is diffused and virtue is preserved. On the contrary, when people are universally ignorant and debauched in their manners, they will sink under their own weight without the aid of foreign invaders." Meanwhile, John was likely the more ambivalent one about heading to Philadelphia. While Abigail was rarely by his side in the modern tradition of political wives, she was the one he came home to, and the one with whom he discussed his ideas. It was her quick wit that sharpened his own, as iron sharpens iron. And when he was called to the First Continental Congress in 1774, it was her voice that told him to go, saying, "You cannot be, I know, nor do I wish to see you an inactive spectator. We have too many high-sounding words and too few actions that correspond with them." Though it may be surprising, by the time the First Continental Congress met, it was John who believed the ultimate course for the colonies would be to split from Great Britain. John also wrote frequently to his wife, demonstrating just how homesick he was in June 1774 as he traveled ahead of the convention of the Congress. "This is the second day of the term at York. Very little business, very hot weather. My refreshment is a flight to Bee, Braintree, to my own cornfields and grass plots, my gardens and meadows. My fancy runs about you perpetually. It is continually with you and in the neighborhood of you. Frequently take walks with you and your little prattling, Nabby, Johnny, Charlie, and Tommy. We walk all together up Penn's Hill, over the bridge to the plain, down to the garden. The 56 delegates who had been chosen by their colonial legislatures to attend the First Continental Congress met to craft a united response to the intolerable acts, debate the merits of a boycott of British trade, declare their rights, and demand redress. 12 of the original 13 colonies attended the First Continental Congress. Georgia did not, primarily because it was hoping for assistance from the British Army in combating Native Americans who were attacking its frontier. Beginning on September 5, 1774, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the First Continental Congress started meeting. Its ultimate aim was, of course, respect for North American constitutional rights to representation in Parliament. Meeting in Carpenter's Hall, where Pennsylvania's Congress met, the delegates aimed to show a united force and authority toward Great Britain. But from the beginning, this would be tough to accomplish, because the different colonies had different priorities. For example, Pennsylvania and New York sent delegates with instructions to seek a cordial and respectful solution with the British, while others advocated separation between their colony and Britain. Some of the colonies had men with far different views. For example, Virginia's delegates included statesmen like George Washington and Richard Henry Lee, but it also included the more fiery Patrick Henry. Furthermore, the objectives of the Congress weren't entirely set out ahead of time, leaving the body to quickly form a leadership and figure out a core set of tasks to carry out. The first few weeks consisted mostly of discussing and debating the issues, and Joseph Galloway of Pennsylvania came up with the first plan, a plan of union of Great Britain and the colonies, which suggested a popularly elected Grand Council among all of the colonies that would be their equivalent of Parliament. This would eventually be undone by the delegates arriving from Boston, whose ongoing troubles with the British made them much more pessimistic about an effort at conciliation. On October 14th, the Declaration and Resolves established the Congress's Statement of Principles, which they considered as common principles for all of the colonies. It was also on this day that Congress voted to meet again the following year if these grievances were not attended to by England. Once that body convened, however, its purpose proved to be very different. About a week later, the Congress formed the Association on October 20th, which was the pact for boycotting English goods. The Association also meant to establish processes throughout the colonies that could regulate resistance and keep it united, as well as improving communication among the colonies. All of the state legislatures, except for Georgia and New York, had their legislative bodies approve of the measures created in Congress. The demands were then sent to Parliament, but Congress received no response. By mid-1775, imports from Britain dropped an astonishing 97%, indicating a highly effective boycott of British goods. Events in the interim months, of course, greatly affected the reduced trade between Britain and its colonies. Of course, time had not stood still while the First Continental Congress met. Upon returning to Boston, Samuel shared with his fellow colonists the Declaration of Rights the Congress had passed, denying Parliament's rights to govern the colonies, and urged them to continue the now intercolonial boycott of British goods. As a member of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, he was instrumental in creating the first organized companies of Minutemen, as well as continuing to serve as moderator of the now secret Boston Town Meeting. But mainly he waited, with bated breath, to return to the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia in May of 1775. While the Continental Congress convened in September, Gage escalated his attack on the political structure of Massachusetts when, in October 1774, Gage canceled the scheduled meeting of the General Court. In response, the House resolved itself into the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, and Hancock was elected president and made a key member of the Committee of Safety. The Congress created the first Minutemen companies of militiamen who were to be ready for action on a moment's notice. Chapter 8, Midnight Riders. Paul Revere would become an American legend for his midnight ride on the night of April 18th, 1775. But the role Samuel Adams and John Hancock played in the events of that night has been mostly forgotten. In early 1775, after being chosen as delegates, Adams and Hancock traveled to Concord for the meeting of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress. Hearing rumors that Boston was now crawling with British regulars, they decided to stay with Hancock's relatives in Lexington until it was time to leave for Philadelphia. Hancock and Adams decided to remain away from Boston because patriots still in town had received intelligence that General Gage was going to receive orders to have certain leaders of the Provincial Congress arrested. The Patriots' intelligence network, which included Paul Revere and his Masonic friend Dr. Joseph Warren, who was also president of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, the highest position in the revolutionary government, had infiltrated the British authorities so thoroughly that they were aware of the orders Gage was going to receive before Gage actually received them. On April 14, 1775, General Gage received a letter from Lord Dartmouth advising him to arrest principal actors and abettors in the Provincial Congress whose proceedings appear in every light to be acts of treason and rebellion. Along with Benjamin Church, Warren was the highest-ranking colonial officer still in Boston in mid-April 1775, and he and Revere worked together closely to gather intelligence and act upon it. In early April of 1775, Revere rode from Boston to Concord to warn the Massachusetts Provincial Congress to move their large stores of arms and ammunition in preparation for a potential raid by British regulars. That ride would also help lay the groundwork for the actions of April 18, 1775. The intelligence efforts on both sides culminated during the afternoon of April 18th, as British troops mobilized in Boston to conduct a raid on Concord in an effort to grab the ammunition and arms stored there. On April 18th, the two men who had been watching the streets of Boston noticed that many of the soldiers had boarded transport boats and returned to the British man of war anchored in the harbor. Further investigation revealed that many of those previously stationed in Boston were no longer in the city. With about 700 British soldiers massing, it was obvious in town that something was afoot. Dr. Warren had received intelligence suggesting that General Gage had also ordered the troops to march to Concord by way of Lexington in order to arrest Adams and Hancock. At least one historian has speculated that Warren received that intelligence from General Gage's own wife. As it turned out, the intelligence was incorrect. Though Gage had been advised to arrest certain leaders of the Provincial Congress, Gage feared arresting leaders might only lead to more unrest in the colonies. However, the Patriots' knowledge of the orders Gage received on April 14th ensured that the Midnight Riders would be sent along that route to warn Hancock and Adams of the British raid. That night, Gage ordered the troops, with utmost expedition and secrecy, to Concord, where you will seize and destroy all military stores, but you will take care that the soldiers do not plunder the inhabitants or hurt private property. Revere and Warren were well aware of that ahead of time, and that piece of intelligence had led to Revere's ride 10 days earlier to Concord to warn about a potential British raid. Now the only question was which route the British troops would use. Around 9 p.m., Warren was confident that the British soldiers would be crossing the Charles River in boats and set out for Lexington from Cambridge. Still thinking the target was Hancock and Adams, Warren asked Revere to leave immediately for Lexington to warn Hancock and Adams what was afoot. Another express rider, William Dawes, was sent over land by going south across Boston Neck and riding towards Lexington. Meanwhile, Revere arranged to have two of his acquaintances, John Pulling and Robert Newman, climb to the top of the Old North Church belfry and light two lanterns as a sign to Charlestown that British soldiers were on the move across the Charles River. Obviously, the signal was not for Revere, since he was the one who ordered it, but was instead intended for Colonel Conant across the Charles River in Charlestown. After arranging for the signal, Revere had himself rowed across the river in a boat he had hidden for just such an occasion. Skirting silently past the British ship Somerset, he landed in Charlestown. When I got into town, I met Colonel Conant and several others. They said they had seen our signals. I told them what was acting and went to get me a horse. I got a horse off Deacon Larkin. While the horse was preparing, Richard Devins, Esquire, who was one of the Committee of Safety, came to me and told me that he came down the road from Lexington after sundown that evening, that he met 10 British officers, all well mounted and armed, going up the road. I set off upon a very good horse. It was then about 11 o'clock and very pleasant. Riding through present-day Somerville, Medford, and Arlington, Revere vocally warned colonists along his route, setting in motion a network of other riders who fanned out across the area to spread the warning. Though Revere is best remembered for warning, "The British are coming," eyewitnesses reported that he actually warned, "The regulars are coming out." It has been speculated that as many as 40 riders relayed Revere's warning, carrying the news of the British troops' march. On his way to Lexington, Revere met with a bit of trouble, but he managed to escape that time. "After I had passed Charlestown Neck, I saw two men on horseback under a tree. When I got near them, I discovered they were British officers. One tried to get ahead of me, and the other to take me. I turned my horse very quick and galloped towards Charlestown Neck, and then pushed for the Medford Road. The one who chased me, endeavoring to cut me off, I got clear of him and went through Medford, over the bridge, and up to Menotomy. In Medford, I awakened the captain of the Minutemen, and after that, I alarmed almost every house, till I got to Lexington. I found Messrs. Hancock and Adam at the Reverend Mr. Clark's. I told them my errand and inquired for Mr. Dawes. They said he had not been there. I related the story to the two officers and supposed that he must have been stopped, as he ought to have been there before me." As Revere noted, though he had left earlier, Dawes was either not as good a rider or did not have as fast a horse as Revere, because he finally showed up 30 minutes later. Revere apprised him of the situation, and the two set out for Concord. On the way they met up with Dr. Samuel Prescott, who was also a member of the Sons of Liberty, but had just spent the better part of the evening in the company of a young lady, and was unaware of the danger when he encountered the midnight riders. In order to appreciate why it took so many men to accomplish this goal, it's necessary to remember that they were trying to avoid British sentries and keep the alarm amongst patriots without warning loyalist citizens of their knowledge. Therefore, no one was shouting, "The British are coming." Instead, they were quietly knocking on doors and hoping to get their message to the head of the house. Because he was known in the area, Dr. Prescott gave them the advantage of familiarity. Unfortunately, the three were not able to stay together long, especially after they were surrounded by 4 British soldiers. They had placed themselves in a straight road that inclined each way. They had taken down a pair of bars on the north side of the town, and 2 of them were under a tree in the pasture. The doctor being foremost, he came up, and we tried to get past them, but they being armed with pistols and swords, they forced us into the pasture. The doctor jumped his horse over a low stone wall and got to Concord. I observed a wood at a small distance and made for that. When I got there, out started 6 officers on horseback and ordered me to dismount. One of them, who appeared to have the command, examined me, where I came from, and what my name was. I told him. He asked me if I was an express. I answered in the affirmative. He demanded what time I left Boston. I told him, and added that their troops had catched aground in passing the river, and that there would be 500 Americans there in a short time, for I had alarmed the country all the way up. He immediately rode towards those who stopped us. When all 5 of them came down upon a full gallop, one of them, whom I afterwards found out to be Major Mitchell of the 5th Regiment, clapped his pistol to my head, called me by name, and told me he was going to ask me some questions, and if I did not give him true answers, he would blow my brains out. He then asked me similar questions to those above. He then ordered me to mount my horse after searching me for arms. He then ordered them to advance and to lead me in front. While Prescott escaped and continued riding, the captured Revere and Dawes were escorted back to Lexington. A short time later, Dawes would also escape and head towards Congress, only to fall off his horse and have to start walking. However, despite being the one whose midnight ride has become legendary, Paul Revere's midnight ride was officially over once the 3 were detained. During the ride back toward Lexington, the British authorities heard the militia fire a volley of guns, likely a warning or alarm, but with that they rode ahead and released Revere, who walked back to Lexington. Revere described the events. "We rode till we got near Lexington Meeting House, when the militia fired a volley of guns, which appeared to alarm them very much. The major inquired of me how far it was to Cambridge, and if there were any other road. After some consultation, the major rode up to the sergeant and asked if his horse was tired. He answered him he was. He was a sergeant of grenadiers and had a small horse. 'Then,' said he, 'take that man's horse.' I dismounted, and the sergeant mounted my horse when they all rode towards Lexington Meeting House. I went across the burying ground in some pastures and came to Reverend Mr. Clark's house, where I found Messrs. Hancock and Adams. I told them of my treatment, and they concluded to go from that house towards Woburn. I went with them and Mr. Lowell, who was a clerk to Mr. Hancock. To Revere's great surprise, he found Hancock and Adams still hadn't left town, despite having been incorrectly told the British soldiers were headed to arrest them. The entire time, Hancock and Adams had been arguing over what to do, with Hancock being adamant about staying in Lexington. Revere helped Adams convince Hancock to get in the carriage, and the group headed towards Woburn, only to subsequently discover that Hancock had left important provincial Congress papers behind in a tavern. As Hancock and Adams kept heading away from Lexington, Revere returned to Lexington to grab the papers, and was thus in the process of moving him as the shot heard round the world was fired on Lexington Green. By the time the British regulars reached Lexington, a small part of the local militia met the British regulars on the village green. Due to Hancock's mishap with the papers, Revere was on hand to provide an account of the first fighting of the American Revolution. An elderly man came in. He said he had just come from the tavern, that a man had come from Boston who said there were no British troops coming. Mr. Lowell and myself went towards the tavern, when we met a man on a full gallop, who told us the troops were coming up the rocks. We afterwards met another, who said they were close by. Mr. Lowell asked me to go to the tavern with him to get a trunk of papers belonging to Mr. Hancock. We went up to the chamber, and while we were getting the trunk, we saw the British very near, upon a full march. We hurried towards Mr. Clark's house. In our way, we passed through the militia. There were about 50. When we had got about 100 yards from the meeting house, the British troops appeared on both sides of the meeting house. In their front was an officer on horseback. They made a short halt, when I saw and heard a gun fired, which appeared to be a pistol. Then I could distinguish 2 guns, and then a continual roar of musketry. Then we made off with the trunk. At first glance, it seemed surprising that the colonists had such a highly developed system of spreading the word of imminent attack so quickly. However, the system was not new. Indeed, it dated back almost a century to the early years when settlers lived in fear of attacks by angry tribes of Native Americans. In addition to riders, there was also a system of ringing bells, bonfires, and even drums and trumpets. Thus, through the coordinated efforts of 3 riders and numerous citizens, people as far as 25 miles away from Boston knew that the British were coming before they even got off the boats in Cambridge. Chapter 9. Lexington. We got all over the bay and landed on the opposite shore betwixt 12 and 1 o'clock, and was on our march by 1, which was at first through some swamps and slips of the sea till we got into the road leading to Lexington, soon after which the country people began to fire their alarm guns, light their beacons, to raise the country. To the best of my recollection, about 4 o'clock in the morning, being the 19th of April, the 5 front companies was ordered to load, which we did. British soldier Jeremy Lister. As Revere and Dawes got under way, about 700 British regulars were preparing for their marching orders under the command of Francis Smith, John Pitcairn, and Hugh Percy. The force that would head for Concord was comprised of various companies, which each had their own lieutenant, while the captains who would command were hastily added, creating a command leadership that made the leaders and men unfamiliar with each other. The 700 regulars started their 17-mile march to Concord around 2 a.m., carrying provisions and ammunition, and it didn't take long for them to hear the sounds of bells, signifying the spreading alarm among the countryside that the British regulars were on the move. The soldiers already knew that their mission was no secret to people they worried would be unruly. Around sunrise, Pitcairn and the men under his command began marching into the outskirts of Lexington. There to greet them were about 80 militiamen who had organized themselves at Buckman Tavern and now stood in ranks on the village green. The militia leader, John Parker, had known about the impending arrival of the British since 4:15 a.m., and he was aware he would be heavily outnumbered. On top of that, he already knew that the British regulars' intended target, the military supplies at Concord, had already been hidden, so he was not itching for a fight. In fact, Parker placed his men on the Lexington Green, where they wouldn't be blocking the road to Concord, and thus not in the way of the British regulars' march to Concord. The militiamen were positioned to be nothing more than a united show of political and military force. Parker would later state, "I ordered our militia to meet on the common in said Lexington to consult what to do, and concluded not to be discovered, nor meddle or make with said regular troops, if they should approach, unless they should insult or molest us. And upon their sudden approach, I immediately ordered our militia to disperse, and not to fire. Immediately said troops made their appearance and rushed furiously, fired upon, and killed 8 of our party without receiving any provocation therefore from us." Today he has been immortalized for another phrase, "Stand your ground, don't fire unless fired upon, but if they mean to have a war, let it begin here." Of course, the British had no way of knowing for sure what Parker and his militia were thinking, so as the regulars marched through Lexington, instead of turning off to head towards Concord, Marine Lieutenant Jesse Adair, who was at the head of the advance guard, moved to protect his men's flank by turning right toward the Lexington Green, ostensibly to confront the militia and potentially disarm them. The British regulars then formed their own battle line across from the militia on the Lexington Green. One of the great mysteries of the Revolution is who fired the first shot at Lexington, but what is certain is that leaders on both sides wanted to avoid shooting. As the two sides stood in confrontation, Major Pitcairn rode forward and called upon the militia to disperse, reportedly ordering them to, "Lay down your arms, you damned rebels!" At that point, Captain Parker actually told his men to disperse, but with all of the yelling and confusion swirling around, his voice was inaudible to many of his men, a byproduct of the fact that he was suffering from tuberculosis. Some began to leave, some did not, and none of them laid down their weapons. It was at this point that somebody fired a shot, and naturally both sides blamed the other. British Lieutenant John Barker claimed the firing started even before the two sides were confronting each other. "At 5 o'clock we arrived in Lexington, and saw a number of people, I believe between 200 and 300, formed in a common in the middle of town. We still continued advancing, keeping prepared against an attack, though without intending to attack them, but on our coming near them they fired on us 2 shots, upon which our men without any orders rushed upon them, fired and put them to flight. Several of them were killed. We could not tell how many, because they were behind walls and into the woods. We had a man of the 10th Light Infantry wounded. Nobody else was hurt. We then formed on the common, but with some difficulty, the men were so wild they could hear no orders. We waited a considerable time there, and at length proceeded our way to Concord. Conversely, some of the militiamen claimed that none of them ever fired a single shot, but militiaman John Monroe claimed he fired in response to the British firing. After the first fire of the regulars, I thought, and so stated to Ebenezer Monroe, who stood next to me on the left, that they had fired nothing but powder. But on the second firing, Monroe stated they had fired something more than powder, for he had received a wound in his arm, and now, said he, to use his own words, "I'll give them the guts of my gun." We then both took aim at the main body of British troops, the smoke preventing our seeing anything but the heads of some of their horses, and discharged our pieces. Other theories abound regarding the first shot. Some of the British regulars claimed the shot wasn't fired by a militiaman, but by an onlooker either in a tavern or behind bushes. Others claimed that the shot may have been the British actually firing on one of their prisoners, Asahel Porter, who was running away from the scene. Other historians, relying on natural instincts rather than the eyewitness accounts, have speculated it was possible that both sides may have fired at each other almost instantaneously out of anticipation, or that individual militiamen may have fired single shots as the British seemed to be rushing toward them to confront them. The British may have fired a volley in response. It's unclear who fired first, but either way, shots were exchanged, and when the militiamen realized they were being subjected to live fire, they began to run away. We, Nathaniel Mulliken, Philip Russell, and 32 other men, do testify and declare that on the 19th, in the morning, being informed that a body of regulars were marching from Boston towards Concord, about 5 in the morning, hearing our drum beat, we proceeded towards the parade, and soon found that a large body of troops were marching towards us. Some of our company were coming to the parade, and others had reached it, at which time the company began to disperse, whilst our backs were turned on the troops. We were fired on by them, and a number of our men were instantly killed and wounded. Not a gun was fired by any person in our company on the regulars to our knowledge before they fired on us, and continued firing until we had all made our escape. While a handful of militiamen lay wounded or dying, the British regulars, still unaware of their actual orders, began charging with bayonets and ran some of the militiamen through. Others prepared to start entering private houses. Eventually, as other British regulars came up into Lexington, the regulars reformed and began marching on towards Concord. 8 colonists lay dead: John Brown, Samuel Hadley, Caleb Harrington, Jonathan Harrington, Robert Monroe, Isaac Muzzy, Asahel Porter, and Jonas Parker. Chapter 10. Concord. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmers stood, and fired the shot heard round the world. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Concord Hymn. The British continued on towards Concord, and by now they may have figured that more militiamen might be lying in wait. Indeed, at Concord they would meet far more organized resistance. At first, the militiamen from Concord and Lincoln considered moving forward to meet the advancing British after hearing reports of firing at Lexington. About 250 of them headed east down the road towards Lexington, but when they came into view of the 700 regulars and realized they were outnumbered, the militia turned around and headed back towards Concord, retreating across the Old North Bridge and reassembling on a hill a mile north of town. From there, they continued to watch the regulars move through the center of town, all while more militiamen swarmed in. The colonists weren't the only ones with handy spies. Pitcairn relied on spies to start searching for weaponry throughout Concord, including at Ephraim Jones' Tavern, where cannons that could be used for siege were buried. The English found 3 cannons there and smashed the trunnions to render them ineffective, as well as destroying gunpowder and other barrels of food. The musket balls and food would simply be recovered from the pond they were thrown in after the British left. On top of that, the British regulars conducted business politely with the residents of Concord, who were able to play off their politeness by distracting them from militia supplies scattered across town. With their ranks gaining more militiamen, Colonel James Barrett began advancing his men from the hill and down toward the bridge. Heavily outnumbered, the British regulars in the vicinity began to give way to the approaching militia. A shot was fired by one of the British regulars, perhaps as a warning shot to the approaching militia. After that shot, 2 other regulars fired as well, which prompted a loose volley from the other regulars. A few of the militiamen were dropped, and the militia seemed stunned until Major Buttrick yelled, "Fire, for God's sake, fellow soldiers, fire!" The colonists, now separated only about 50 yards from the regulars, fired volleys over the heads of their own front lines and shocked the British regulars, wounding 4 of the 8 British officers and sergeants, killing a few regulars, and wounding 9 others. The regulars then broke and took off, leaving the stunned militia unsure of what to do next. Meanwhile, the other regulars still searching around Concord passed by the spot where the quick fighting had taken place and found their dead and wounded, but they continued marching into the town, while the militiamen continued to keep defensive positions out of range. The regulars continued their activities in Concord until noon, giving colonists from across the countryside plenty of time to meet up and contest the British march back to Boston. Chapter 11. The March Back to Boston. As militiamen swarmed toward the action from neighboring towns and villages, the British forces began the march back to Boston, and they would soon find that they were facing emboldened opposition. By the time the British made it back to the safety of Boston, thousands of militiamen had surrounded the city, beginning what would become a nearly year-long siege. The British could now see about 1,000 militiamen assembling as they began marching east out of Concord back toward Lexington. To march across the bridge where the shots had been fired earlier, the British had to reform their lines, giving the militia time to start firing at them as their column marched over the bridge. A few regulars were killed and wounded, and they kept a rear guard and flanking troops to delay and contest any passage by the militiamen. The regulars' troubles were just beginning. More militiamen from Chelmsford had assembled in the woods along the road around Brooks Hill, and when the British came upon them, they charged to try to scatter them. However, the militiamen held their ground and sustained fire on the British, inflicting more casualties. As those regulars tried to deal with the militiamen from Chelmsford, the bulk of the regulars found another company of militia nearby and engaged them, killing and wounding several. As the British reached the outskirts of Lexington, a familiar face was there to greet them. According to one of the militiamen present at Lexington, Captain Parker and his militia had reassembled and waited for the British to come back, and when they did, Parker ambushed the British column, leaving both Major Pitcairn and Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith wounded. With their two main leaders injured, some of the regulars started to flee, and others surrendered. Just when it seemed the British were about to surrender en masse, a cheer rose up on the other side of Lexington. British officer Hugh Percy had arrived with a full brigade of about 1,000 regulars, the result of a request for reinforcements that had been sent back to Boston around 4 a.m. earlier that morning. Percy and his men arrived at about 2:30 p.m., just in time for the besieged regulars. Back in Boston, General Gage had received the reinforcements request at 5 a.m., and in the confusion, the order for reinforcement was sent to the desk of Major Pitcairn, who was not in Boston, but was just about on the Lexington Green at the time. Due to that and similar delays, Percy and his men left Boston just before 9 a.m., playing Yankee Doodle to taunt Bostonians along the way. Percy and his men had arrived in Lexington around 2 o'clock to the sounds of gunfire, and thus formed their lines on high ground outside the town. They offered a rally point for Smith's men and Pitcairn's men as they scrambled away from the militias. Seemingly safe, Percy took command of the British forces and let them all eat and rest before getting ready to march back to Boston. Once again, the British would be contested on the march. Militiamen would ride up to within firing distance, take pot shots at the marching regulars, then mount their horses and ride forward, ready to repeat the cycle. On both sides of the British columns, colonial militia took pot shots, moved forward, waited for the British to advance, and then fired some more. Eventually, the regulars sent out advanced messengers and units in an attempt to confront and intercept the militiamen. Percy later explained these tactics and their results. "The rebels attacked us in a very scattered, irregular manner, but with perseverance and resolution. Nor did they ever dare to form into any regular body. Indeed, they knew too well what was proper to do so. Whoever looks upon them as an irregular mob will find himself very much mistaken." The tactics were effective, but they also enraged the British. When one militia unit setting up an ambush was intercepted by advanced flankers, 11 of them were killed, and it was alleged that they were shot after surrendering. Since the militiamen were firing from behind walls, trees, and buildings, British regulars would sweep these areas and even enter homes and confront and sometimes shoot residents in them. Some taverns were ransacked, and the regulars helped themselves to the liquor, getting drunk along the way. As the British limped back toward Charleston, one militia force from Salem and Marblehead were in position to cut them off entirely, but for reasons that are still disputed, they did not contest the British regulars' escape. It was dusk by the time the British rearguard entered Charleston and the relative protection of their naval guns. By the time the last fighting ended, some of the British regulars had marched about 40 miles in 20 hours, nearly half of which was spent marching under fire from militia, and some had not slept in 2 days. Immediately after the battles of Lexington and Concord on April 19, 1775, the militiamen who had poured in from across the countryside converged on Boston, which at the time was a peninsula with a small neck attaching to the rest of Massachusetts. With the Charles River surrounding it on 3 sides, Boston was an ideal city to lay siege to, and there were about 15,000 militiamen encircling the besieged British forces. As if to underscore the importance Samuel Adams and Hancock had in bringing about the American Revolution, shortly after the fighting at Lexington and Concord, General Gage issued a proclamation granting a general pardon to the colonists who would lay down their arms and return to the duties of peaceable subjects, with the exceptions of Hancock and Samuel Adams. The American Revolution had officially begun. When he heard of the fighting, Samuel Adams himself is said to have proclaimed, "What a glorious morning is this!" This has been From the Sugar Act to the Shot Heard Round the World, America Before the Revolution, written by Charles River Editors, narrated by Nicholas S. Johnson, copyright 2012 by Charles River Editors, production copyright 2015 by Charles River Editors.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.